May it please the court. I will argue point one of appellant's brief and stand on the brief as submitted with respect to point two, answering any questions that the court may have. The issue which is presented to this court today for resolution is whether a challenge to the timeliness of a pro se Rule 29.15 filing is in fact a non-jurisdictional affirmative defense that is waived if not timely asserted. In past years, the time limitations under Rule 29.15 were jurisdictional, and the failure to timely file a Rule 29.15 motion deprived the court of jurisdiction to hear and determine the merits of the motion itself.
What case out of this court has held that the timeliness requirement was jurisdictional?
There are cases holding that when you don't timely file a pro se motion, it deprives the motion court of jurisdiction.
Are they Supreme Court cases or are they Court of Appeals cases?
I believe there is a mixture of cases from courts of appeal and possibly also from the Missouri Supreme Court. I know that there are a number of cases that hold this, and some of them would be cited within the appellant's brief itself.
Is it necessary that that we reach the jurisdictional issue? I mean, what if we just followed the plain, ordinary meaning of the rule, which says it shall be filed? Why is it absolutely necessary that your argument be couched in terms of jurisdiction?
Well, if it is a jurisdictional issue, then it is an issue that can be raised at any time, because jurisdiction can be raised at any time, whether it be on appeal or whether it be in the trial court. If it is not a jurisdictional issue, then this court has held if a matter is not jurisdictional and is procedural in nature and is required by statute or rule, then it may be waived if not timely asserted.
I saw the word statute or rule in that sentence in the brief, but it doesn't cite any cases that deal with rules, just statutes. That's why I asked the question.
I believe that the jurisdictional issue itself is one that needs to be resolved, because if it is a jurisdictional issue, then, as I said before, it can be raised at any time. If it's an affirmative defense, then the state would waive it by not timely asserting it.
I understand that argument. My question is, assuming that the trial courts have jurisdiction to err, if we have certain rules that say things shall be done at certain times, why do you say that necessarily those things are waivable when the rule says shall?
I say that such things are waivable because previously the court held it was jurisdictional. The time limitations were jurisdictional or deprived. If you didn't file within a certain amount of time, then you deprive the motion court of jurisdiction. And there is case law from this court in McCracken versus Walmart Stores, which states that if the matter is not jurisdictional, then it is procedural and it can't be waived.
I understand that there was a time period when jurisdiction was defined differently than now, and I understand your argument. I guess my question is past that, is assuming that the trial court has jurisdiction and our rule says that a party shall do something, if something says shall, why is that necessarily waived by any party? Why isn't that something that the trial court could take up on his own motion? And the trial court dismiss it because the rule says it shall be filed and it hasn't been, therefore I dismiss it.
I think that there are policy considerations that should be taken into account when deciding whether or not this particular rule, and I think you're talking about the rule itself, which says the failure to timely file within a particular under the time limitations allowed by rule constitutes a complete waiver of any right to proceed.
Now, I'm not trying to get into a semantic issue regarding jurisdiction and authority, but McCracken was based on Webb, and it said even though there's a statute of limitations, that has to be waived. It said you shall file within a certain period of time. The defendant has to raise that as the affirmative defense. And the Webb case, it would say that the Constitution gives the jurisdiction to the circuit court to hear these cases. Whether or not they have the authority to hear the cases is another question. The jurisdiction versus authority question is something that's been raised by a good Judge Wolf some years ago.
Yes, and I believe there is
a jurisdiction or authority issue.
I believe there is a footnote in another case that was heard before this court, Anthony Moore versus the State of Missouri, indicating that, yes, the time limitations under Rule 2915 cannot be seen as depriving the court of jurisdiction, and maybe more properly termed as depriving the court of authority.
You mentioned that affirmative defenses could apply, but a motion for 2915, unlike a petition, doesn't require responsive pleading. So how and why would Rule 5508 kick in?
I think that Rule 5508 and Rule 55.27 should apply to post-conviction proceedings. The state, again, they still do not have to file a response according to rule if they don't want to. But our argument is if the motion is untimely and they want to assert that particular defense to the pleading, that it then should be indicated or set out in a responsive pleading to the motion that has been filed by the post-conviction movement. There are policy considerations for doing that. The rules, 55.08 and 55.27, serve a number of purposes in civil practice, the first of which is to provide notice to the petitioner of any affirmative defenses, and the second of which is to present, define, and isolate any controverted issues.
But likewise, 2915 has its policy reasons, too, to prevent stale claims and to bring some finality to these types of proceedings. Can you weigh the two policy concerns together?
Yes, I can. I was about to say that increasingly there is litigation over the contested issue of whether or not a pro se filing is timely or not. And because of this, this litigation, again, has been driven by case law from this court and other courts, recognizing that there are some exceptional circumstances. If we're going to require the assertion of this as an affirmative defense, a challenge to the timeliness of a pro se motion as an affirmative defense, and I'll only give notice to the movement himself that they're seeking to dismiss his action, but also you'll give him the opportunity to present any evidence or testimony showing that there are exceptional circumstances justifying the untimely filing, or showing that, in fact, his untimely filing, which appears to be untimely on its face, is timely by application of the law. Again, there's increasing litigation over this issue because there are these exceptions. The case law is developing in this area. And there are these circumstances, and the court has recognized that there are circumstances where exceptional circumstances would justify the untimely filing.
A little bit beyond McCracken, because McCracken was regular pleading. And as good Judge Russell said, there's no responsive pleading required. But in McCracken, there was, and there is a provision for affirmative defenses. There is no responsive pleadings required here. But you're saying we should require it if you're going to say if the state wants to say there's no authority to go forward.
Yes, I think that Rules 55.08 and 55.27 should be applied to require the response when it is untimely filed. Of course, the state can always choose not to respond, but then the consequence of that failure to respond would then be waiver of the affirmative defense challenging the timeliness of the person.
If I understand your balancing of the equities, you're saying, because it's, at least in some cases, I'm not sure it is here, there's a factual issue as to whether or not there's been waiver, and if you can raise that for the first time on appeal, there's really no mechanism to get the facts out before the court because we don't hold factual hearings.
Right. I think enforcing the rule as it is at this particular point in time overlooks the fact that there are these exceptional circumstances that do occur. They're rare, but they do occur, and that they are provable through evidence and testimony.
Are you
and once the case
are you
gets
talking about claims of abandonment? Is that what you're talking about?
I'm not only talking about claims of abandonment, but there are also situations where a pro se motion can look untimely on its face, but in fact be timely filed under application of the law. And that would occur, for instance, where the circuit clerk's office receives the pro se Rule 2915 motion within the time limitations permitted by rule, but for some reason does not file stamp the pro se Rule 2915 motion until several weeks or months later, making the pro se Rule 2915 motion appear to be untimely filed.
What case is that? Do you have a case where that has occurred?
I don't have a specific case where that has occurred. The cases that I have cited are Howard, Spells, Nicholson, and McFadden. However, I'm speaking from personal experience in dealing with this particular issue on a fairly regular basis. There are instances, at least, that I know of where the envelope containing the pro se motion was file stamped when it was received, and then for some reason the circuit clerk's office did not take the pro se motion out of the envelope, and they didn't file stamp it until months later, and when they file stamped it, it was out of time.
Well, we do have cases where it was sent to the wrong address or the old address or somehow wasn't properly forwarded, and I think there's one where it was received timely but only a few days later filed. But the thing we're struggling with is why isn't it up to the defendant? Or one thing we're looking at is why isn't it up to the defendant to put on the evidence of timely filing? Whose burden is it to show it's timely? Is it your burden to show it's timely or the state's burden to show it's untimely?
Well, I think that what we're asking is that Rule 55.08 and 55.27 be applied to post-conviction proceedings to make it so that the state has to assert that it is untimely. Then, of course, that would give the post-conviction movement the opportunity to then challenge the assertion that it is untimely through any evidence or testimony that he may have if the court is willing to hear it.
If we do not accept your suggestion that Rule 5508 and 5527A apply, if you assume we find that those do not apply and no responsive pleading is necessary, do you lose? Is there an argument or a claim that you make that doesn't require those rules to govern?
With respect to point one or point two?
Point one.
In this particular instance, if this court finds that 55.08 and 55.27 do not apply to require the state to assert the defense, then in this particular instance, then there would be no error in the dismissal of the case. Now, I do know that there are, my client has indicated that there are reasons for his untimely filing. His untimely filing reasons do not neatly fit within the categories of Howard, Spells, Nicholson, or McFadden.
And you talked about that there had been some expansion of the court's ruling that permitted untimely filings, but the last cases out of this court, and I apologize that I can't cite them by name, they made very clear that there was no intention to be an expansion, that they applied the limitations pretty strictly, didn't they?
I am familiar of at least one case that I argued before this court myself. But there are still those limitations. And again, there are other cases from other courts that deal with the receipt of the pro se motion by the circuit clerk's office being when it is filed as opposed to when it is file stamped. And there are definitely situations that.
Are there any more questions? Thank you.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by saying that Mr. Doris's argument relies on a false premise, and I think it is a premise that Judge Stith was exploring just a moment ago. And that's the idea that a post-conviction proceeding is an adversarial proceeding between the state and the defendant or the movement, just like any other proceeding. And that's just not so. The post-conviction rules mention the prosecutor only twice. And that's that the clerk has an obligation to serve notice of the pro se motion upon the prosecutor, and subsection C, 2915. And subsection G is that the prosecutor, any response from the prosecutor to the amended motion shall be filed within 30 days.
As a practical matter, clearly the prosecutor takes an opposing position to the defendant. I mean, that's, well, I've never seen a case where that didn't occur.
Well, chances are good that they're not going to agree with the motion, and they have a right, I think, under the terms of the rule to be involved, but they don't have any responsibilities under the rule.
And the flip side of my question to opposing counsel is that does it make sense to have an issue that may be a factual issue be allowed to be raised for the first time on appeal, whether or not you have a formal obligation to file an answer or to file a motion, if you want to raise something that can be based on facts, don't you have to do it at the trial level so there's an opportunity for that factual issue to be explored? How does defendant know that you're going to be contesting timeliness if somehow it's not raised at the trial court?
Well, I'll tell you why. It's that subsection B of 2915 says, failure to file a motion within the time provided by this rule shall constitute a complete waiver of any right to proceed under this rule 2915 and a complete waiver of any claim that could be raised in a motion filed pursuant to this rule.
So if a defendant files something and says it was timely, and they think it is, can you on appeal then bring in something that wasn't raised at the trial level, say, you know, show that for some reason you think that it was not timely filed or that they mailed it to the wrong address or whatever it may be? I'm not sure how that addresses this issue of being able to raise something new on appeal where they had no opportunity to address it and put in additional facts that they didn't know were contested.
You mean, can the defendant put on additional facts on appeal?
For instance, in the issue of venue, if we have similar kinds of issues arise and we've indicated, this is a little different because it's pleading requirements, but we've indicated that you need to indicate the reasons why you think venue is bad, because otherwise you're requiring the other side just sort of to address every possible venue issue, and that's just a waste of resources. They need to know which one, you know, you're claiming applies and which one you're claiming doesn't apply, so that the arguments to the court can be focused on what's really at issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering here if it's appropriate to, or whereas it's sandbagging in some instances, not that I'm saying it was in this particular case, to allow them to wait until appeal to raise some issue where the defendant may not have realized it was being contested,
mm-hmm.
and therefore had no reason to bring
okay.
it up.
Yeah, let me try to unpack that.
That's a long question.
Right. Several things. First, I think the rule makes clear and precedent makes clear that it is the movement's burden to plead and prove the timeliness of his motion. So Mr. Doris's argument that he had no notice or that he needed formal notice that timeliness was going to be an issue, I think, is not supported by the case law or by the rule. But I do understand that he's arguing that sometimes he may file a post-conviction motion that he believes is timely, and then through no fault of his own, because the clerk screws up, it ends up being filed untimely. So what then?
Is that an issue in this case?
It has never been raised as an issue in this case. I heard for the first time when Ms. Robinson was talking that he had some reason that it was untimely filed. That's never been raised before.
But what I'm trying to figure out, if we had that situation, if we were to adopt your rule, I'm sorry, is there what is the mechanism for dealing with that would exist for a defendant?
Well, I think there are a couple of possibilities. One, a defendant can file a motion with the court apprising them, the circuit court, apprising them of the reasons that apparently their document got file stamped with a date that was later. I mean, there's nothing that would prevent, an amended motion is right around the corner, by the way. But if the court is so proactive that it dismisses the motion like the next day, because it appears to have been untimely filed, then the court retains jurisdiction over its judgment for 30 days, and the movement can file a motion to reconsider. And I mean, that information can be presented to the circuit court without.
But you had notice. You had notice of the circuit court proceeding. You had notice of the 2915 filing. And when we get to, again, the web analysis is interesting because it used to be jurisdiction, you could bring it up any time, but we're now talking about authority. The circuit court had authority the year 2915, whether or not, and so it's not, I'm not sure Webb would say it's jurisdiction, it would say it's authority, and so maybe it can't be asserted at any time. Why didn't you save the court time and just say, this is out of time? You had no. You did have notice of the proceeding in the circuit court.
Why didn't the prosecutor do it?
Yes.
Well, I mean, it would have been nice. I mean, there's nothing that would have stopped the prosecutor from doing it, but there's nothing in the law that requires it.
Has there been a Supreme Court case that has held that it's jurisdictional?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
I didn't see one cited in Ms. Robinson's brief.
No, not to my knowledge.
The issue was eventually heard to the trial court based upon an amended motion filed by counsel, correct?
The substantive issue.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So if counsel was aware, I mean, counsel could look at the docket sheet just like the court could. If counsel was aware that the file indicated that it was filed late, I mean, whenever their counsel is appointed to file an amended motion, they could in their amended motion, they could say things like, well, it looks like the clerk file stamped this on this day, but if you look in the file, it was obviously received on such and such a day. I mean, those are things that could be brought up in an amended motion. The issue is who has an obligation, if anybody does, to put the trial court on notice.
Oh, without a doubt, Your Honor. And in fact, I think the question of who has the obligation has been answered. And it's that the movement has an obligation to plead the timeliness of his motion. And I think that obligation continues into the amended motion. I mean, it does sort of supplant the pro se motion. And timeliness needs to be alleged. Yes, Your Honor.
Could this issue have been raised sua sponte at this court for the first time?
Yes. I think that the timeliness issue is something that continues throughout, and because the movement has no right to relief under the post-conviction rules.
And the policy reasons for that, which the question of policy was raised by your opponent, the policy reasons for that is because there has been a full trial and a full adjudication of guilt, and this is a special proceeding. This isn't just a typical proceeding. This is where a challenge to a conviction that could have been appealed and would have been appealed and affirmed in most cases. Isn't that an important consideration for policy?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that this court has made that point in White, which is a case that's cited in my brief. And it points out that the post-conviction remedies provide a remedy that's heretofore unknown in the law, I think is the word.
But, post-conviction, there was always habeas, and the post-conviction proceedings are simply a codification of what you could do under habeas without restrictions.
Well,
you always had a right to raise those issues.
Well, I mean, the issues can be raised.
You always
but the
had
procedure
a right to raise the things that we now raise in our post-conviction motions. Prior to them, you raised it under habeas.
Yeah, I mean, the
so
issues were
novel.
still available. I mean, you know, it's what the court said.
It doesn't give a remedy that didn't exist. It simply gives a mechanism.
Right, but the particular mechanism is limited to the time limits that are expressed.
So
right.
if we find this 2915 to be untimely filed, does the defendant have a remedy by habeas?
Well, I mean, at this point, there could be preservation problems. I mean, you know, he failed to follow the procedures that are set forward. And my understanding of the habeas proceedings is he would have to be able to show cause and prejudice to overcome procedural default. But, I mean, if he was able to meet that burden, then perhaps he would be able to.
Habeas is just as available to him now as it ever was.
Right, right. Unless there are any further questions, I'll conclude by asking the court to, in this case, vacate the order below and remand with instructions that the motion be dismissed as untimely. Thank you.
Thank you for a sound use of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counselor, I have a question. Since you're suggesting that this is an affirmative defense, what other than untimeliness, what else would you consider that the state would have to raise as an affirmative defense to a post-conviction motion?
My argument is not to expand beyond what the Missouri Court of Appeals in Western District suggested in Snyder and in their subsequent opinion in Girl.
Right.
We are just suggesting that the state be required to plead the untimeliness of the Rule 2915 motion.
And I guess I'm trying to figure out the implications of that. Other than untimeliness, what other things do you think the state should be required to plead if we adopt your position? What other affirmative defenses or things would you categorize as affirmative defenses?
Offhand, I don't know of anything at this point that creates the kind of difficulty in determining who is actually entitled to proceed and who isn't entitled to proceed as the timeliness issue does in post-conviction practice. So I would not, add any additional affirmative defenses other than that
about,
particular
what about,
one.
For example, failure to state a cause of action for which relief could be granted. Is that something now that the state would have to raise? I mean, that's listed as an affirmative defense in the rules that you're suggesting apply.
I don't think that it's something that the state would have to raise. I do or have noted in post-conviction practice that states or prosecutors that are more diligent actually do review the file. When something is untimely filed, it is raised sometimes by certain prosecuting attorneys. If they feel as though it doesn't state a claim for relief, They have filed motions in particular cases. To require it is not what I'm requesting. What I'm asking that this court require is that they assert the untimeliness of the pro se Rule 2915 and Rule 2435 motion. Lastly, I want to say that I disagree with the state's assertion that it is the obligation of the movement to plead or to put the court on notice that the motion is untimely. I think that actually that is contrary to the duty of loyalty to the client and may actually violate the Missouri Supreme Court rules of professional conduct.
Their argument was that your client has a burden of proving it was timely. So it has a burden of showing why it's timely if on the face of the record it doesn't look timely.
But I think that there is an issue as to when that burden of proof would apply. Does that apply after the state asserts that it is untimely, or is the state then stating that movement has an obligation to upfront say, yes, this motion is untimely,
Do you disagree with Mr. Farnsworth's statement that there is case law that says it's your client's burden to show timeliness?
I don't know. I do not want to speak off the cuff without having had an opportunity to review which case law he is referring to. So I would not disagree with it at this point, but I do disagree with the assertion.
His brief did not mention any case law that would be reflect on that burden?
The state would probably be better to answer that question because if the case law is cited in his or her brief, it.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.